or voyage.
Voyage.
So not have that get
No, no, okay, we won't do that.
Not even a little bit.
Bon voyage. Don't you say
no.
that?
No. Mm-mm.
Welcome to Airspace from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, presented by Olay. I'm Nick.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Matt.
Today we're going way back into the archives of film and science fiction history for a viewing of Georges Méliès' classic, The Trip to the Moon, or, if you want to get fancy in French about it, Le Voyage dans la Lune.
Méliès' films were groundbreaking in their time. He was part of so many firsts in film history, and in 1902, Voyage was no different. It's the first film to depict space travel, and it's often referenced as inspirational by filmmakers and sci-fi creators.
While Méliès' films may seem simple and almost maybe even primitive to modern eyes, many of the techniques in filming, editing, and storytelling evolved from his films and are still used in the film industry today. We're taking a voyage to the moon today on Airspace. It's an old movie. It's one of the oldest movies. It is very old and very, very much in the public domain. So if you haven't seen it, you can grab a few different versions on YouTube. And it's only 13 minutes long, so we encourage everyone to. But Matt, I have a question. Can you flow us a little history here? Because I suspect that this movie is so popular and influential that even if you haven't seen it, you've likely seen it.
Yeah, I mean, just to pick up an obscure reference, like if you're like me and you like British comedy and you watched the Mighty Boosh series and you've seen the way they depict the moon and the man in the moon and that's taken straight from this film.
And what Matt is referring to is the black and white man in the moon up in the sky, and you see a face and the face is kind of moving. And famously, and this is, I think, the iconic shot that everyone will remember if you remember this film at all, a spaceship lands directly in his eye. It looks pretty baneful.
So since we are not great at being concise about things that we get excited about, I challenge you, Nick, to summarize the plot of this 13-minute film in 7 sentences.
Why 7?
I think the better question is, why not 7?
Okay, challenge accepted. 13 minutes. That does call for a pithy summation. Let's see if I can get it. A group of scientists get together, and one of them proposes a trip to the moon.
Well,
because every great science fiction epic has a spaceship, this one is no exception. It is a cannon that fires a bullet with the group inside of it.
Duh.
They land in the eye of the man on the moon with a big splat. It's a very famous scene.
Duh.
They explore the moon, which is full of colorful mushrooms, plants, waterfalls, rocks, and they go to sleep dreaming of dancing girls and stars for reasons of, I guess, popular demand. You know, movies at the time, not different than movies now.
Four.
Lunar creatures attack them, and they run away and make them disappear by hitting them with their umbrellas, which is the most, like, Edwardian thing you could really imagine.
Five.
They're captured and brought to the court of the lunar creatures.
Six.
Then later escape.
Seven.
The scientists rush back to Earth, but they bring one of the moon creatures back with them and teach it to dance. And everybody gets a medal like Star Wars.
Eight.
That was 8. I'm sorry. I couldn't do it in 7. So, first thing, this was based off of a Jules Verne book, largely. Is that right, Matt?
Yeah, it's based on From the Earth to the Moon, which was one of Jules Verne's most famous novels. And it, like the movie, depicts a group of scientists, astronomers, who decide that they can do it, that they can get to the moon, and that they can use a giant cannon with a projectile and go inside of that projectile and fly to the moon through that. Only I would say that Verne's novel is a lot more serious than Méliès' take on it. Like, Méliès, it's bright and colorful, it's humorous. Jules Verne was more suspenseful and harrowing. You don't know if the scientists who are inside of the projectile have survived after the big explosion that sends them off to the moon. And if you know any physics, you know that, in fact, they would not have survived, because being fired inside of a projectile out of a cannon is pretty much the same as being hit by a projectile that's been fired out of a cannon. So, you know, it doesn't actually physically work, but Verne used it. It was his conceit, because the rocket was not in the popular consciousness yet. And so ballistics was one of the ways that science fiction authors used to make up for the fact that they didn't have a technology that could actually send people to the moon or to Mars or out into space.
Okay, so there's a lot of great history here. I've seen this in like a midnight screening, a lot of energy, good crowd engagement. It was a fun experience, 13 minutes long. Emily, had you seen this before? What'd you think?
No, so not surprisingly, Emily hasn't seen this. So this was my first experience watching this movie, even though I had heard about it. I knew about it. I certainly had seen The Man on the Moon, right? The classic Man on the Moon that I have in my head, of course, is the Man on the Moon that you see in this film, too. But I had no other preconceived notions going into this other than this is one of the first sci-fi movies ever made. So, like, this is going to be a really cool experience. And I was so focused on it being the first sci-fi film that I ended up getting totally caught up in some of the sort of problematic tropes that exist in this film, right? You know, scientist equals man. So, right, it's this big group of bumbling scientists, right? Which is never a great trope that I particularly enjoy as a non-bumbling human, in my opinion. But also, there's a lot of women in this movie, but they're all kind of wearing leotards, kind of, I don't know what the right word is, like helping them. They're just sort of like walking across the screen at all times in their little Edwardian leotards, which I thought was really weird. And, you know, we move into the environment on the moon, and I had a lot of very strong feelings towards the lunar, can we call them extraterrestrials? I don't know what you call the lunar creatures, but like these lunar creatures are these painted mass creatures with spears that are clearly aggressive, that are then trained as entertainers when they're accidentally returned back to the Earth. There's this weird colonial vibe to it that really struck me as super icky, which made it a little bit hard for me to kind of go back and rewatch the film for what we were watching it for, which is this is the first science fiction film, which doesn't excuse the ickiness, but at the same time, like, made it hard for me to concentrate. And I was curious, Nick and Matt, like, did you pick up on this or was it just me? I mean, I recognize that you have to take it into historical context, even though that's not like an excuse.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, you know, and on the one hand, that's what Méliès wants you to feel. Especially when it comes to the sort of critique of imperialism and colonialism, which was something that he was absolutely trying to have come through, was, you know, here are these bumbling authorities, the old guard, the white beards, they're going to go somewhere that we've never been before, and they're going to totally muck it up, and they're going to bring back, you know, in a very sort of imperialist and chauvinistic way, something from that planet and turn it into just an object of entertainment. But then on the other hand, it's also a product of the time and Méliès' own prejudices, which include, you know, this sort of misogyny of the era. And you're right, it's not something that we can just excuse because it's a product of its time. So it's a complicated thing, like to appreciate what is sort of forward-thinking and critical about the film while also remembering that it has its own flaws that are obvious to us today, and that, you know, it's very correct to bring up in a setting like this.
So this movie is known for a lot of things. It's not necessarily known for its groundbreaking commentary, but it is groundbreaking in a lot of ways. So why does this movie still matter today?
Well, I mean, one of the things that it definitely did in practically every scene was to create, I would even say, something out of nothing, right? It creates the illusion that you are in different places, that you're seeing the actual projectile that the scientists are getting into, that you're on these other landscapes. you know, the way that Méliès used perspective and also, you know, things that would become very standard in filmmaking, like, you know, painted backdrops, what we would call matte paintings, and two-dimensional props that are made to look three-dimensional, forced perspective to make a space look bigger and things look like they're more, you know, a sort of deeper field of view. All of that stuff, Méliès is doing a lot of it for the first time anyone's ever seen it on film. And the fact that he's able to put all of that together to tell a coherent and imaginative story, I think, is one of the reasons why it persists today.
Yeah, so one of the big breakthroughs here was simply having a narrative. One of the most successful films before this came out was a 3-minute clip of a train coming towards you. Not a lot of story there. It's just kind of a technical demonstration. So the idea that there were characters and that they went somewhere and did something was, at the time, groundbreaking.
I think one of my favorite parts of this story, because I've never taken a film class in my life, so I understood what this movie was just from talking to you two. But what I think helps understand the way Méliès was pushing the boundaries or trying to push the boundaries, or what kind of got him excited about this, was that he sort of started looking at filmmaking, which of course was in its really early days at this time, as an extension of his magical act. So I think it's very curious that all these bumbling scientists are dressed up like, let's be real, they're dressed up like wizards. They're not dressed up like scientists. And I think that's really, to me, that's amusing, even though perhaps not intentional, that Méliès first started thinking about how film could be used to kind of enhance what he was already doing on the stage.
Yeah, and that's something that can seem old-fashioned and not futuristic when we see it with modern eyes, because it's not like they just filmed a play, but it's clearly informed by live theatrical performances in the way that they just build the box for the story to happen in. But at the time, that was cutting edge. Emily, to your point, like, it does feel very theatrical in the, like, live theater sense, and they're doing these really dynamic sets, but that was brand new at the time. That's part of, like, the idea that there's a fabric, like, to the story.
Right, and along those same lines, you know, one of the things that I didn't know about this film that I thought was really interesting, especially with the, oh my gosh, you guys are going to think I'm such an old person, with all the TikToks that the kids are doing these days, you know, this felt in some ways like a really early version of that, in that, like, there's this scene right at the beginning where all the astronomers are holding up their telescopes, like, into the sky, and then you can obviously see the film jump, but then, like, they're all holding chairs instead, and they, like, put the chairs down on the ground and they, like, sit down, so they've, like, somehow transformed their telescopes into places to sit. That's essentially stop motion photography, right? And I think that I've never made a TikTok, so I don't know how people do these. Or reels, Instagram reels, I don't know. You guys know what I'm talking about, where people, like, make the outfit changes happen really quickly.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's not stop motion photography. And he's really one of the pioneers of that technique. So y'all are welcome. So we've talked an awful lot about how everybody's seen this and it's been around for a really long time and it's really easy to get to. How influential was it?
So, all right. So what we've said is that this was one of the first movies where somebody really kind of tried to tell a story. That's big, you know. A lot of really influential directors that followed Méliès call him out by name, and this film in particular, for inspiring them. Edwin S. Porter is widely credited as being a father of American cinema, and he names Méliès specifically as an inspiration. So we're kind of talking about a person that cracked a particular code and inspired, like, the entire next generation in waiting, and they expanded upon his work and spread it around the world.
Yeah, and, you know, not that long ago, Martin Scorsese in 2011 made his love letter to Méliès, which was his film Hugo, in which there's a character based on Méliès and the things that Méliès created.
Georges Méliès. That's Papa Georges' name.
If you remember, Hugo was one of the first 3D feature films to be shown in theaters. And so Scorsese was trying to sort of use the first narrative film, The Trip to the Moon, as the basis for the story in a kind of roundabout way of the first feature-length 3D movie.
Yeah, like, filmmakers love this movie so much that sometimes they pair it with real space exploration. Tom Hanks produced a limited series called From the Earth to the Moon that was kind of mission by mission, very, very accurate retelling of the Apollo missions. And for the final episode, the final mission, Apollo 17, he just swerved. And half of that episode is the story of Georges Méliès filming Voyage to the Moon.
Monsieur Méliès oversaw every moment of the making of the film. He was also the lead actor, playing the Professor Bumblefouillet.
Which, in Tom Hanks's mind, belonged exactly alongside our final actual voyage to the moon. It's a great story. So we've actually got a version of Voyage to the Moon in the museum's collection, but it's not the full 13-minute film sitting in a canister.
Right. You could experience this movie on a smaller scale on a technology that was called a mutoscope, which was something that used a large number, like hundreds of cards, more than 800 cards, on a sort of Rolodex-type thing inside of a cylinder with a crank on the outside, so very steampunky from today's standpoint. And, you know, when you turn that crank, you got about a minute of viewing.
So this was like a crank-operated machine that you would find in the back of a shop, an even more compact version of like an old Nickelodeon theater where you would just go in and everything's playing on a loop.
Yeah, exactly, like sort of a small-scale personal experience. If I could put this into a little bit of historical perspective, like if we're talking about the end of the 19th century and like the fact that you now have this very large urban working class population, a lot of whom are young people, who now have disposable income, movies and other forms of diversions like this, like we're talking about Nickelodeons, there were also ice cream parlors and small amusement parks like in Coney Island. Like this was really the dawn of sort of popular consumption of this type of media experience. So it's kind of cool that we have this in this format, in this mutoscope format.
Airspace is from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. It is produced by Katie Moyer and Jennifer Weingart, mixed by Tarek Fuda. Airspace is presented by Olay and distributed by PRX.
Well, science is magic, really, so
valid.
I see the connection.
Which is why they're dressed as wizards.
That's right.